Hello, everybody. Stu Smith here with another Tactical Fitness Report. We're actually on 200 today. Thank you, Dr. Chris Free, for joining us on this milestone podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Stu. I'm really excited to be here. As I was saying just a few minutes ago, you're kind of one of my heroes. I've used your training videos for myself to train myself, and I've also certainly recommended them to many others. Interestingly, most of the Army Special Forces guys I know who you are because they used your videos for preparing for selection.
Oh, that's cool. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. But first, let me introduce Dr. Chris Free to everybody. Sorry, Chris Free to everybody. He's a clinical psychologist, a professor of psychology at the University of Hawaii at Hilo, and his research focuses on clinical trials, epidemiology, and mental health services relevant to the design and implementation of innovative treatments and mental health service improvements for people with post-traumatic stress. And I found out about you after doing some research on stress mitigation for an article I was doing for military.com. And once I read some of the neat things that you were doing and what you were calling the syndrome that is now what people are starting to refer to as operator syndrome. You're actually giving it a name, which I think is very beneficial. Some people think that it's giving it a name is maybe not so beneficial, but then you give it a name. So I wrote an article about operator syndrome, which is all you're doing, and the term allostatic load, which was the first time I'd ever heard of that word. And when I was writing the article, I had to dig in some more research, and you kept popping up as the guy. So I'm so honored to have you on here to discuss some of the issues that occur when stress becomes chronic. So real quick, let me just kind of, I know this is a tactical fitness report.
Yeah.
But a lot of times people don't realize that tactical fitness comes in multiple phases. And you can look at this as like the phase of someone's career. So when you're a recruit, you're really focusing on phase one of tactical fitness, which means your training should look more like you're preparing for a fitness test to enter the job that you want to be. Especially if it's in the spec ops world, it's going to be competitive. You got to score well on that test. Then you got to get through the training, which means whatever specifics of your selection that you are preparing for, your boot camp, police academy, fire academy, whatever that is, you need to prepare specifically for that. So that's phase two. And then you're an operator. And that also looks differently because you're really kind of just maintaining your abilities to do your job, but you're also introduced to stress mitigation and some resiliency training for a reason. And we'll get into some of those. And then I don't really go into this very much, but there is a phase four of tactical fitness, and that is the post operator. That is retirement, or, you know, former, you know, you did 8-10 years and you're getting out of the military and you're now a former, you know, operator. So let's think about tactical fitness in those four phases and really focus on the phase three and phase four of the career. But also, you know, it's not a bad idea for phase one and phase two guys to start understanding what this is. And so just think of it as a class that you're teaching at the University of Hawaii there. So let's learn a little bit about operator syndrome.
Right on. Well, so where would you like me to start, Stu?
Well, let's kind of define operator syndrome and why it was so important to take a wide variety of symptoms and give it a name.
Sure. Okay. Well, first off, let me just thank you for your article, the article you wrote in military.com. When I first read it, I was like, wow, this guy really did a terrific job.
Oh, well, thank you.
Of characterizing some of my thoughts, but also turning it and building it up into some, you know, integrating it with tactical fitness and some of your work and ideas. So I thought it was a really effective article. And I know it got a lot of traction. A lot of people saw it. I had people sending it to me for, you know, like I would get one or two a day of people saying, hey, have you seen this? I'd be like, yep, it's good. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
So maybe I could start by telling my story a little bit, because sometimes, sure, you know, data points are best understood in context of a story. So I have a story. So and I'm gonna go back to my childhood, actually. So I grew up in the kind of the shadow of the Vietnam War. My father was a Vietnam veteran. He was a physician. He was not a combatant in the Air Force. But I grew up with a lot of awareness of that, and my father's perspectives of what the war had meant and what it had, how it had affected many of the people who had served in it, as well as the Vietnamese. He had Vietnamese friends that we welcomed in the U.S. And I also had another role model. It was my great grandfather, who fought at the Battle of San Juan Hill in 1998. And he lived to be about 100. So I knew him as a child, and both my great-grandfather and my father's experiences and just kind of growing up with that awareness put me in a spot where when I went to graduate school, when I started graduate school in clinical psychology, I wanted to work with veterans. That's what I wanted to do. That was my goal. I've never served, but I did work at the VA for 15 years, first 15 years of my career in a PTSD clinic, full-time clinician for 7 years, then clinician and researcher, started getting large federal grants. In 2006, I left the VA, moved to Hawaii, the University of Hawaii, did some other stuff, and had some work in Houston that I was doing. Most recently, University of Texas stood up a center for veterans mental health in the psychiatry department of the UT Medical School in Houston. And part of my work there, I got to know a lot of the veteran community in the city of Houston, and was working with a friend. This is goes back about 6 or 7 years ago, who had just left the Navy SEALs, SEAL teams, and he had been at DevGru, and he was having all kinds of problems. I was like, dude, what? You know, he was what, mid-30s, late-30s? It's like, well, what's going on? And somebody had said, oh, Freeza, an expert in PTSD, you ought to talk to him. So we start talking, and we keep talking over the course of weeks and months. He doesn't have PTSD. Wasn't what I was expecting. He had symptoms of depression, symptoms of anxiety, but he had none of the fear reactivity that goes with PTSD that you expect with PTSD. That's part of that condition. So I was like, huh, okay. Then it was like, well, you know what? Some of this stuff is weird. Why would he, like the sleep problems he was having. So we do a sleep study. We find out he has sleep apnea. We do a urology study. We find out he's got extraordinarily low testosterone. Sleep apnea, low testosterone. Now I'm scratching my head because I've not, like, it doesn't make compute. It didn't make sense to me. So we work our way through these things one by one. We start finding, let's look at this. Let's look at this. What can we do to treat this? So he gets on testosterone. He's doing much better. Pretty soon, and there were certainly psychological issues there. I don't want to say this is all biological, but pretty soon he suggested to a friend, another friend of his, who I didn't know, and said, you ought to talk to Chris. Maybe he can help you with some stuff. Pretty soon, word of mouth, I built up a small pro bono practice of about 10, 15 hours a week. And I continue that to this day.
Nice.
And what I've seen is the same pattern of difficulties over and over again. It started to get like Groundhog Day. Why do all these relatively young, fit men have sleep apnea? Just didn't compute. Why do they have low testosterone? And I started, you know, now that's like, let's first thing, let's get an blood levels. Let's get your endocrine levels checked. Testosterone, thyroid, estrogen, believe it or not, a lot of guys are showing elevated estrogen, which can lead to a variety of health problems, including things like clotting, blood clotting. So from there, it was like, I started talking with people, care providers in the special operation world. I got to know some of the psychologists at Virginia Beach, Coronado, some of the docs at Fort Bragg, a lot of conversations with care providers of a variety of different stripes. And then talking about that with my community, my colleagues outside of the military, and started to put these pieces together. I actually wrote the operator syndrome paper that you referenced was originally just a white paper. It was just a document on my computer that I started writing to share with the guys I was consulting to. Hey, read this, see that you're not the only one. See what this is a common pattern. So I started sharing that and got like overwhelmingly positive feedback just from that. Like, wow, this was so helpful just to read. So then it was like, okay, we're going to write this and share this with the world. We published it in a pretty decent medical journal last year. And it's got a lot of attention since then.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw it then too. So what were some of the, if you have a long list, I imagine there's a long list.
Yeah. Let's go through it.
Yeah. What were some of those?
Well, let's start first with what makes special operations special. And I always like to say, to begin with, it's more unique than it is special in terms of how it affects people's bodies and the needs that guys and some gals have. It's not that, oh, you are special forces, so we're going to give you something special we don't give to anybody else. It's not that. Some people think it's that. It's that what the guys and the gals of the special operations world do is so unique, so different, and magnitudes of levels of exposure are so different and so far beyond what most conventional forces experience. And it's not all conventional forces. There are conventional forces that have a lot of these same experiences and difficulties. So for me, it starts with, think about what your typical operator has learned to do and spent 10 to 20 years doing. Jumping out of airplanes, diving in the water, rappelling out of helicopters, days, weeks, months in training courses, where breacher courses, demolition courses, rocket courses, firing rockets, even just a rifle, how many rifle trigger pulls? Those are all cumulative blast waves. Mm-hmm. Pulling the trigger on a rifle is probably a micro blast wave. Being too close to a charge on a door, that could be a very significant blast wave. And we've not understood blast wave exposure in terms of how it damages the brain. We're just beginning to think about that. For decades, it just got lumped in with an impact blow to the head or falling off a horse. It's a completely different type of injury. And we're just now coming to see that. Postmortem studies that have been done in the last decade show very different kinds of signature patterns in the brain after accumulation of impact forces, like you get in a boxer or a football player, versus the kind of head injuries, the brain damage and brain injuries we're seeing in folks who have had a lot of blast wave exposure. Because the blast waves are a shearing force that goes through all the soft tissue in the body. So they affect the lungs, the brain, the delicate muscles around the eyes, probably the inner ear, function circuits that give us balance and such.
And, so, and many of our hormonal organs as well.
And hormonal organs, yes, thank you. So for me, and I think a lot of us, traumatic brain injury, chronic stress, pain and loss, and other physical injuries all kind of add up to endocrine dysfunction, like low testosterone, misalignment of estrogen and thyroid, very common. We go from there to sleep disturbance. TBI causes sleep disturbance. The work schedules, the shift schedules for most military units, not a lot of sleep there. Hypervigilance makes it hard to sleep. So for a lot of reasons, guys from the community don't sleep well, but also they have sleep apnea, which is a diagnosable and treatable condition. We do a sleep study. Guy spends a night in a lab, sleeping in a lab. We monitor breathing, heart rate, brainwave activity, other circadian rhythm factors like sweating, digestive functioning. We do that, and I don't mean to say we, because I'm not a sleep doc, but that's I send that out.
Part of your team.
Part of the team, yeah, or part of the expertise that you need. And by the way, that's a good point. This is a multidisciplinary team that's needed to help folks with this. There's a CPAP machine, continuous pressure airway something something, that you sleep with. It forces air into your lungs. guys say it makes all the difference if they have sleep apnea. Then on the list, we've got chronic pain from umpteen bazillion small and large orthopedic injuries. We've got the immobility of those orthopedic injuries, chronic headaches for a lot of guys that turn into migraines. Then we get into kind of the psychological stuff. So substance use, heavy alcohol use is pretty common in a lot of in the cultures of a lot of units. It's also really, really bad for the brain, bad for sleep. It's a bad habit to pick up for a lot of health reasons. Depression, anger, stress reactivity. I'm going to list post-traumatic stress disorder here, but I'm also going to say I don't really see it. I don't see PTSD separate from depression and anxiety too much. What's missing, so PTSD, let's talk about PTSD for a moment.
Sure.
It's depression plus anxiety plus fear reactivity to traumatic cues. And the guys that I've worked with have not shown that fear reactivity to traumatic cues. They can watch war movies. They can talk about their experiences without becoming emotional. They most of the guys I know still hunt, still use, still like to shoot, still like to do many of the same activities they did when they were active. Hmm. Anger's a problem. Worry and stress reactivity are a problem, especially on the post-transition to civilian side. And let me just talk about transition here a little bit, because that itself is such a powerful part of this. And, you know, I don't know anything about your transition experience, Stu, but I'll say this. I don't know anybody, whether they were in for 4-year enlistment or a 30-year career, that finds it easy.
Oh, no, there's so many changes that occur. My year of getting out was, I got out. I had to find a new job. I had just moved into a new house. And I had a brand new baby all in the same year. I don't even remember that year.
Yeah.
There's so much was going on. So, right. Yeah, it's a tough transition.
You're adopting to new roles for yourself. Your family is adopting to a new role of having you there. Civilian culture is a different culture. So there's a little bit of a culture shock. Plus, there's just some like basic life skills that a lot of folks don't need or learn while they're in the military. You've got a spouse that pays the utility bills, you may get you may find you have no idea how to pay utility bills or even where to look for them. Simple, kind of stupid things like that can be huge, can add up in a big way. Yeah. So worry and stress reactivity. Now we're with the family, marital, parenting. Those become challenges. The divorce rate in a lot of units is extraordinarily high, and the divorce rate for a lot of guys in the first 2 years after leaving the service seems to be a time of risk for marital dysfunction and divorces. And I'm going to put in here sexual health is an issue, certainly low testosterone, but also comfort with emotional intimacy. All the time of having been separated and been apart off and on for years. All the health problems we're talking about also can have an effect on family and relationships at home. Being hypervigilant, having memory problems. One of the common things I hear all the time when I talk to spouses is the little bit of a thought that maybe their husband is getting out of doing home duties by claiming to forget things. Did you take out the garbage? Oh, I forgot. Are you ready to go to the store today? Oh, I forgot. A lot of spouses look at that as, he's gaming me or he's playing me. But really, a lot of guys just have very significant memory and attention problems. And
they is that a short-term memory issue?
Yeah, they go together. If you're having trouble concentrating and focusing, you're not attending, you're not going to be able to remember what's being said to you. If your mind wanders, you can't remember it. But even if you pay attention, your memory won't be as good after
a TBI. You know, Doc, I was reading something about short-term memory loss, and being in a threat environment. When you're constantly in a threat environment, that short-term memory is constantly getting dumped to assess the new threats that every environment that you go in, you walk through a door, short-term memory gets dumped. Right. You know, it's a very interesting thing that unfortunately you get good at doing it.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I still go to the grocery store and forget half the stuff I'm doing just because I walk through the door. I might remember it in my car, but I walk through a door, I'm completely forgot my list.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole level of different type of task saturation that occurs at that point.
True.
You're attending to all these other stimuli. There's people here, there's potential threat. You're looking around and then you forgot that list of things that might have been in your head. I'm just going to finish the list.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. No, you didn't interrupt at all. And I appreciate questions. Vestibular balance problems, again, inner ear stuff. Certainly hearing problems are common. Tinnitus is common. And that's not unique to operators per se, of course. Visual problems. A lot of guys have some blurry vision or some double vision that seems to be about connected to the tiny ciliary muscles that guide the eyes, that direct the eyes where they're going to go and even are involved in the focusing of the lens. Transition difficulties, we kind of talked about this, but like, how do I fit into this new culture? I've just lost my entire tribe, so who am I now? Who's my new tribe? Who do I feel comfortable with? Who can I trust? What am I going to do now? How do we make decisions about, do I need to go back to school? Do I have a job? Am I going to work? Am I going to be truly retired at some point? Those are kinds of questions that folks struggle with. I mean, for our listeners, imagine, and I'll use myself, imagine if somebody came and tapped me on the shoulder tomorrow and said, well, doc, you're done as a psychologist. You've done your 30 years, you're done. Time to go do something else. Good luck, goodbye. We're going to send you off to this society, American society, where everybody speaks the language, you'll fit right in, and don't worry, it'll be easy, right? So I get into the civilian society and I don't know what some of the acronyms are. I don't know what some of the phrases are. They don't know my acronyms. The people don't know my acronyms. So there's a cultural shift. And then you've got the existential stuff. You've got the, you've had a mindset that discounts the future because the future is not promised. Going into a combat zone, going on deployments, on dangerous missions, on dangerous training activities, you know full well there's always a chance of life and death is always on the line and tomorrow's not promised. So get the most out of today. That's discounting the future. That's when we do things right now in the moment that are going to help us feel good, even though we may know, 20 years from now, I may be sorry I'm drinking this or eating this or engaging in these activities, discounting the future. Death over comrades, survivor's guilt, and just that whole, I think I'll just finish the list with the whole question of what is the mission and purpose of life now after the military? How do you go from doing the kinds of things that you did, the life and death, global implications, important missions, doing things to protect the country and doing it with a team of people around you that you feel really great about being with? What do you do after that? How do you go from that to sitting at a desk shuffling paper clips? The truth is most guys don't do that. They don't do that. But so that is what I have been calling operator syndrome. And I want to be really clear here. Our paper was descriptive. It's not brilliant science. It's not the most rigorous scientific paper I've ever written or anybody's ever read. It's just a very humble descriptive paper. The phrase operator syndrome, I probably did start using that at some point, but other people have been using it as well. So for example, I met a doc at Fort Bragg. We started talking. I used that phrase. This is before our paper was published. And he was like, oh yes, that's the same phrase we've been using.
Oh, nice.
Same thing with the physician's assistant out at Virginia Beach. We were talking and he throws out this phrase. I was like, yeah, we call it operator syndrome. He goes, we call it that too. So I think it's just it was a very intuitive way to think about it and talk about it. And I view it as a framework. It's not a medical diagnosis. Operator syndrome, there's no medical diagnosis. You won't see it in a medical book anytime soon, but it's a framework for understanding how the behaviors and experiences of special operation folks over the course of time, how it comes to affect pretty much every part of their brain, their body, their psyche, their families, and their lives. And they're all interconnected. So to send a guy off to get treated for PTSD, or to say, oh, you've got PTSD, go to the VA, here's some medications, it's not going to address the root causes. It's not going to address the whole picture.
Well, I love the term operator syndrome for that reason. It is putting all of that into the same envelope, right? And whenever you can read that, like you said, a framework. So my question for you is, if you have many of those symptoms, I would imagine you can say you have operator syndrome and not have every one of them.
Right. Absolutely.
And you might just have might have two or three that are just really severe. What does that do hormonally to the person? What is, you mentioned, there is some physiology behind this.
Oh yeah.
Is the, hormonal imbalances that you're seeing besides the testosterone? There's more to go on that.
Yeah. So let me describe to you, what a man with low testosterone is going to appear like to other people. Because this is often how I get it. So the operator with low testosterone, and sometimes they'll just tell me what the number was. Like I'll say, if you've been tested, yeah, what was your number? And they'll say 230. And I'll go, stop right there. With the testosterone of 230, let me read your fortune. Let me read your palm here, so to speak. You have a testosterone level of 220, 230. Let me tell you what that means. You're not sleeping very well. You're irritable. You have very low energy. You feel tired all the time. You have getting into the gym is really, really tough. You walk into the gym and you just don't have the strength. You don't have the stamina. You don't have the ability to stay in there or the desire to stay in there like you used to do. And you're just not feeling like yourself. You're depressed. You feel really depressed. You feel like you can see you've put on weight. You've lost your sex drive and you are just feeling out of sorts, like you barely recognize yourself, and your partner, your significant others may be saying the same kinds of things. Now that individual goes to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist. It doesn't think about the endocrine aspect of things. They're going to end up being diagnosed with depression and put on antidepressant medication, which probably isn't going to help them at all. I mean, it might help a little, but what they need is testosterone. That's the root cause here. I had a friend of mine yesterday who just got out of the Army a couple of years ago. He got his levels tested recently. Very low testosterone. He's been supplemented. It's now a couple of weeks into his treatment. He called me yesterday and he said, "Doc, my goodness, I feel completely different. Everything is great. I've got energy. I'm sleeping. My wife loves me again." It was just like, for him, it was in the moment, and probably for a while will be a miracle, a miracle change agent.
Now, how about some of how about some of the other hormones? Do you see higher indications in those, like your adrenaline, your cortisols, the stress hormones, or do they tend to balance out?
Well, I have not been directly measuring those.
Okay.
But I think there's a chronic level of elevated cortisol while people are active, for sure. And there's some really cool stuff. Jeff Dardia down at Fort Bragg is doing some work to actually study this, part of a human performance and wellness program within Third Group. And they're doing some great stuff tracking this stuff. I know NSW is now doing much more to track the outcomes of guys. A lot of the units, what we're seeing now in a lot of the units is they're using wearable technology like Whoop bands or other kinds of, some are the Army's even using some proprietary products to track things like how much sleep does somebody get? What quality of sleep? How much time in REM? How much time in slow wave? Because those matter as much as just the overall number of hours. That's important. Those same trackers will typically track activities. calories burned, you know, expenditure of energy, and they will track things related to recovery. And so I know this gets into your wheelhouse. I think our nation's special operators are overtrained and under-recovered.
Oh, absolutely.
Massively, massively. In fact, I have guys that are now, I know one of my friends, he's been retired for 6 years. He's still doing, he's for a while, he's doing these workouts. It just crushed him.
Mm-hmm.
He needed to learn about the role and the importance of recovery. So the macho side is you crush it no matter what, but that's just not smart. You need to leave room for the recovery and to measure the recovery. And that's now being talked about and thought about and studied more, I think, more carefully.
Absolutely. And you're mixing all these things together that, you know, really is what I have seen throughout tactical fitness with the overtrained under recovery. Sleep's a major part of that. Low testosterone is also an indicator that you're overtraining.
Yep.
You know, this is before they're even an operator.
Right.
And they're getting into that stage already. One of the last things you need to do is when you're burning the candle at this end with your work and your lack of or night shifts and, you know, special ops missions and all that. And then you go burn the candle at the other end with your personalized training programs. You know, it is a really quick fuse to really have you facing all of the symptoms or nearly all of the symptoms of overtraining, which are many that you just listed, you know, as the, you know, some of the operator syndrome on a more chronic level.
Right. And that takes us back to allostatic load. The concept of allostatic load, which is really a hypothetical construct, but it's the idea of everything that's putting a burden on you. Every one of those workouts, hours of sleep that were lost, stress, all of that together, injuries, all of that together is what we call the allostatic load. So it's not measuring a very specific thing, but it is kind of like the weight of everything.
Yeah. I always try to explain it as like, we're in a balance.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, you have your life, your work, your workouts, your physical, you know, stresses, your mental stresses, emotional stresses all on one side. And then you have all the ways to recover. And let's get into some of those. So from nutrition to sleep, you know, balancing your workouts properly. So programming is very important. So all of those have to be in balance, and you know, one's out of the other. It doesn't matter if you have the perfect training program or whatever, and you're not even working that hard, you throw in several weeks of not sleeping well, and you can have all those chronic symptoms really quickly.
Yeah. So for me, this list of things we just talked about, I mean, I kind of started with it from a clinical perspective. In other words, guys that were mostly no longer active or kind of into their career, needing help, needing medical care to feel healthier and to have a better quality of life. That's the clinical perspective. I've gotten more into thinking about the operational side of things, the performance side of things. And that's, you know, I think that's what you're talking about here. So the clinical side is, let's treat disorders or conditions after they've developed. But the stress mitigation side, the performance side is everything, you know, from the beginning of the career to the end of the career to going forward are all the mitigation things, that the lifestyle, the habits, the changes that we can make to increase our energy and our health. So let's go into that. What are, from the performance side of things, where would you like to start? I think in terms of sleep, diet.
Well, let's start off with this question. How about sleep as, you know, being the number one recovery tool? However, when we cannot sleep, it is also a snowball of chronic stress symptoms soon to follow.
Right.
So what are the best ways to start working on sleep training again?
Yes. So I agree. Sleep is probably the most important place to start from a performance perspective, but it's also a smart place to start because everybody wants to sleep better. It's not, if I come to you and say, hey, Stu, I think you got a psychological problem and we should treat that. You might be like, yeah, up yours. Whereas if I come to you and say, Stu, you're not sleeping enough. Let's help you sleep better. You're going to be like, right on. You'll sign up for that.
Sure.
So, and the good news or the clever news is that if you focus on helping somebody improve their sleep, you're helping them with a lot of other things along the way as well. So for sleep, I like to start off with just basic sleep hygiene. What are you doing in the hours before you go to bed? Are you stressing yourself out with things? Or are you relaxing? And then there's a whole bunch of things like, can you take melatonin or magnesium a couple hours before bed? That helps a lot of people sleep. Warm shower helps a lot of people sleep. Bedroom engineering, the environment is oftentimes very important. Get the TV out, get the clocks out, get the lights and the noise out, those kinds of things. So I do some just basic sleep hygiene. But then you get into the level of questions of, well, what are some of the other root causes why somebody's not sleeping?
What should you not do?
Yeah. Well, yeah, right. Yeah. So let's minimize alcohol use. Yeah. Let's not do things like have stressful work or family conversations right before bed. Those are some of the don'ts. But then there's the things like, okay, you're not sleeping because maybe your testosterone is low. So we got to address that. To help you sleep, we got to check your endocrine levels. So to help you sleep, which is our goal, we're going to draw some blood, let a urologist or an endocrinologist look at that, and we'll go from there. Then you get into other things like, well, maybe pain is interrupting sleep. So we need to understand the pain and what is the nature of the pain and where is it and what can be done to mitigate that. Maybe you're on too many medications is another thing. I frequently see that guys are on 8 to 10 medications coming out of the service.
Wow.
And I frequently see guys who have gone to the VA. I was at a meeting a few weeks ago, and one guy, we were talking about the problem of overprescription that they perceive as occurring at the VA. That's not me saying that. That's what they were saying at this. This was a board meeting of a national foundation. And that turned into the whole conversation was, we want to do things with our people that involves less medication. One guy said he'd been on 22 medications with the VA. Another guy said he'd been on 20, and they both were really, really sick until they got off of all those medications, and then they start to feel better. So there's a lot of, some of what we need to do is undo the medical treatment of people that came before us possibly, or maybe not undo it, but reset it for the new circumstances of the operator's life.
Right. How about caffeine intake? Is there a particular amount of time you should have your last caffeinated drink of the day?
Yeah. Caffeine has a long half-life. Yeah. So any caffeine that you're drinking in the afternoon is still with you when you go to bed at night. I would recommend not eating any, drinking or consuming any caffeine after about midday, after about noon.
Okay. I think that's a great piece of advice because there's not uncommon for many people to still be having caffeinated drinks later into the afternoon, early evenings, and then, they're not going to sleep till 1 or 2 in the morning.
Right. So, and that's probably something that I and other care providers probably maybe don't ask enough about, but I do try to remember to talk with people about their caffeination. Coffee and tea are both really good for you, but if the caffeine is still in your system when you're trying to sleep, it might not be that much.
How about hydration? Just pure water.
Yeah. Drinking water, being sufficiently hydrated, super important. And I don't quite understand why a lot of the folks that I talk to don't like water. Don't like water. And so part of my program is helping people learn to like water.
It's needed. Water.
What else?
So sleep being the number one, how about what I think number two is your nutrition and your gut health that
yes
is also part of nutrition that a lot of people don't really appreciate.
So I was thinking about a talk I'm going to give later this year on performance. And I was thinking that the number two issues, if you said to me, you got two issues that you can work with people on, I would say sleep is one. Number two is gut health.
Nice.
And if you take care of both of those, along the way, you're pretty much taking care of everything else in the course of that. Gut health is so important. And we are just now learning about the microbiome, gut bacteria that we all have within us that's symbiotic with us. It's not parasitic, it's symbiotic. We need that bacteria within our guts. And obviously it needs us, we're the host for it. We did a study that was just published about a year ago where we collected fecal samples from psychiatric patients who we had these are not veterans, but general psychiatric patients. We had followed each of them. We had data for about 6 to 8 weeks on each of them in terms of psychiatric symptoms and changes. We collected the fecal sample and we worked with the microbiologist to sequence the bacteria and put it all together. And what we found was a very clear signal. Gut bacteria is there's a marker there that's a signal of depression and anxiety. We found at least a hint of it in an empirical study. We also, with over 100, I think we had 110, 111 subjects, we also were predict retrospectively, but we could have identified the people just from the fecal sample who are not going to get better.
Wow.
6% of our population, of our sample, didn't get better. And we could see that after the fact. We could identify them from the fecal sample. So we know gut health is super important. So what does that mean practically? And this is something I do like to coach people on. So, you tell me, maybe I need to learn a little bit from you, but I think a healthy performance diet is going to have lots of seeds and nuts and fiber, a good balance of fruit and vegetables, lean proteins. I think we've as a society, I think we've overestimated the risk of fats and underestimated the risks of sugar and processed.
Oh, absolutely.
So I talk to folks about fats, fine. Get the good fats, olive oil and such. Avoid sugar, avoid the processed foods, never eat junk food, never eat, just food that you know is not going to be good for your system.
Yeah. So what types of foods are good for your gut health? So when we talk about, high fiber foods, probiotics, fermented foods.
Absolutely.
Right. So in a nutshell,
probiotics,
prebiotics.
Probably the best way for me to answer that question is to tell you what I'm going to have for breakfast when we're finished here. I make a smoothie for myself every morning, and I start off by putting 4 or 5 different seeds and nuts in there. So a little bowl of that, always, usually walnuts, usually flax seed, and then chia seeds, hemp seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, put that in there. I'll add blueberries, strawberries. My wife grows a lot of fruit in our yard, so there's always fresh fruit from that. I'll throw a little bit of fruit in there, a little bit of carrots, either yogurt or kefir to give a little more probiotic. Put my nuts and seeds in there, some water, protein powder. What else do I throw in there? Oh, I put cinnamon in there. I put some of the mushroom powder extracts. Sometimes I put green spinach or other greens, and then I just blend that baby up and slurp it down. And
I tend to do the same thing, Doc. I do a yogurt, super greens, protein, and fiber. Actually use Beneful, right? A scoop of Beneful in there add to the fiber. Cause I tell you, as I have aged, I have found that to be very helpful.
Yeah.
You're right. It does help with producing a better digestion of all the good things that you've eaten. And that's the key. If you don't have that gut health there, you're going to miss out on the bloodstream's going to miss out on that, all the good that you've just added to your diet.
Right. And we have the vagal nerve that connects the vagus nerve that connects the brain and the gut to each other. And that sends there's a lot of information that goes up and down that nerve, both, in both directions. So we know that our gut is almost like our second brain.
Sure.
That's how important it is. A lot of neurotransmitters and receptors, serotonin receptors, dopamine receptors in our gut system. So taking good care of it is good for our concentration and our mood as well as our physical functioning. Stu, I use a form of intermittent fasting in my daily diet. I was going to be curious to hear what you think about that. I usually try to eat breakfast around 10 or 11 in the morning, and then my last meal about 6 o'clock at night. So about an 8-hour feeding window each day.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I think you need to find a way to eat that works for you and your energy requirements.
Yeah.
For one.
And there's a lot of individual differences there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, if you think about what you're doing, you are just eating less, which is very important. You know, there's the old saying that a lot of nutritionists hate is move more, eat less, right? And because it typically people will take it as like they quit eating enough good food, right? But yeah, when we say eat less, we mean eat less, smaller serving sizes of good foods.
Yeah.
So I have been a big proponent of eating healthy, like everything that you just named there, from good carbs, good fats, you know, fruits and vegetables, you know, laying off of the anything fake, anything that is man-made, and working really hard to, you know, proteins, all forms of proteins. I'm not one that would eliminate any macronutrient ever. And focus on smaller portions. Because when I was a younger kid, when I learned to eat, I was learning to get big, you know, for athletics. And, you know, I was learning to eat to gain weight. I was a hard gainer as a teenager.
Right? You were eating for the mission of that point in your life. And now you're eating for a different mission.
I'm eating, you know, my best PRs right now are when I go to the doctor and I see my blood pressure's low, my triglycerides low, and my, you know, cholesterol's low. Those are the PRs I'm trying to hit every year. Of course, I still run and swim and lift weights and do all the physical activities too. But, you know, when you get over 50, you know, some of those become a little less important on maxing out anything. You know, I have this new saying: after 50, you know, 80% is the new 100%. And what that has enabled me to do is not get injured. Because every time I get injured, it's from lifting too much or running too fast or running too much or doing too many repetitions. Just drop it down a notch, you know, and then that also helps with your ability to recover better. And hormonally, that looks more healthy as well.
Yes.
So,
and a lot of former operators, as they get into their 50s, are still training like they're 20.
Oh yeah. You got it. There's some new rules after 40.
There should be some new rules. Yeah. That come along. And what I remind my guys is that, you know, you're in the service, you train for the mission, right? Whatever your mission is, that's what you're training for. Now your mission is different. So your training needs to be different. You need to align the training with your goals. And I'm 57. My fitness goal is to be able to, you know, as you said, to have good cardiac, good lipid levels and all of that. But from a big picture, I want to be able to walk and mobilize and live my life and do my activities for as long as possible.
And without pain.
And without pain.
That's huge.
And without suffering. Right.
Yeah. I have I actually have an article, New Rules for Fitness Over 40. Number one is, number one is you can't outwork your diet. So eat well. Number two is, you know, start to mix in non-impact cardio activities versus running all the time.
Yeah.
Right. Number three, you know, don't be scared to drop one of the hard workouts of your typical week and turn it into a mobility day. Do a day of yoga, do a day of of what I call my mobility day looks like this. We do 5 minutes of non-impact cardio followed by 5 minutes of stretching or foam rolling. And we do mm-hmm. that five times. Mm-hmm. Now, originally I was doing that just for me and a couple of the older guys that were training with me. We would do that and let the younger guys do their harder workout. But then some of the younger guys started joining us, you know, say, hey, I think I need a break. I'm going to join you guys today. Hmm. And then I just started making the whole group do it because mm-hmm. I saw their performance improve. If we did that yeah. on a Wednesday, their Thursday, Friday, Saturday workouts were so much better
yeah.
than crushing it on Wednesday.
Right.
So they actually added that little easy day in the middle of the week, and it's just mobility work. And it, you know, it was fun to see guys walk out of the gym and feel no pain for the day. Like I can walk out at age 52 from this workout and I'm like, wow, I feel like I did something. My lungs are open, but I don't hurt.
Yeah.
Nothing mm-hmm. is in pain. So that's a huge win, especially if you're coming from a background of athletics when you were a teenager, or maybe even in college or beyond, then you went into the military and did some form of spec ops or tactical profession.
Mm-hmm.
And you did that for multiple years, maybe even up until the age of 40 when you're pretty active. Because what happens after 40 is all of those injuries that you've had in the last 20 years, maybe even 25 years, they start to revisit you again.
Yeah, they're going to
they start to say hi.
Yeah.
And you have to you have to address those smartly. And I have found that mobility day to be very helpful. And sometimes we even do two mobility days a week just to, you know, really knock it out and fully recover. So,
and I think those old injuries are doing more than just saying hi. I don't think they're that friendly.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of what they're reminding you of. Yeah, that's great. I love that. Yeah, it's about training for the mission. And a lot of the guys I talk to now or work with now, they have grandchildren. So, hey, your mission is to be around for your grandchildren for a while. You want to be able to pick them up and hold them on your lap. And you want to be able to go for walks with them and play catch with them and ride horses with them or whatever. You got to take care of yourself and be smart about it.
That's a good point. And so let me just circle this back to the family life real quick. We have listed a ton of symptoms from things that your loved ones may see before you, as well as some things that your loved one can help you with, from nutrition to sleep environment and all of that. What are some of the pieces of advice that you would have for spouses that are also dealing with a veteran that is
that's a really good question, important question. So we know that to be married to an operator is a challenge. I mean, that's a whole different lifestyle than almost anybody else in America is living. To be the child of an operator is an incredibly different kind of experience. The children I know a number of teenagers, talked with a number of teenagers. What they describe is a sense of pride in their usually it's the father, a sense of pride in their father's service, and maybe a sense of I want to be like my father. I want to, like a lot of the boys I know are wanting to go into become the same type of operator as their father was. So that's pretty common. But they also talk about the heaviness. How many funerals? Think about being a 15-year-old. Right now, and your father's been an operator your entire life, how many funerals have you attended? 20, 30? Yeah. How many men who you used to think of as your uncle, who you called uncle, are now dead? How many other children do you know your age who've lost their parents in combat? So there's a heaviness there. And then you get into things like the parent was kind of never really around. I think I saw an estimate that the average operator is there for about one out of three birthdays, one out of four birthdays for their children. Wow. One out of four Christmases. I mean, they're just away a lot. They're not there, which puts a lot more burden on the spouse, obviously. And it creates a family system that functions without the operator. And so when the operator comes home, it's almost, that's stressful too. That's a different kind of stress.
Oh, sure. In fact, one thing I have learned whenever I would come home, but also made this recommendation often, when you are the person who comes home, is there's a system that works without you.
Yeah.
And you can screw that up really easily.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, just let it go. Right. And just let the system work. And you just kind of join the system and swim with the same current versus trying to swim up current and changing everything because you don't like the way this is done. It's been working fine without you.
Yeah.
That's good. That can cause a lot of problems.
That's well said. Yeah. And so what aspect of from your training can you take that will help you fit in with a new environment? That's something that most special operators are very good at, going overseas and fitting into new environments and figuring out what the system and the rules and the situations are.
That's a very good point, because
a lot need to start applying some of those lessons.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's so many applications that you learn tactically that you can use personally to help make a stressful situation less stressful or not get it into a stressful situation.
Right.
Like you just mentioned, your ability to adapt to new situations, right? Breathing. Yeah. Breathing is a huge way of doing it. And we learn how to relax and breathe right when we pull the trigger, right? There's a reason we do that. You can add that same skill that you just learned to right before you shoot.
Right.
Take that big deep breath and relax, you know, practice some breathing. Box breathing is huge. You know, so there's so many things that we can take from, you know, the skill sets that we've learned, you know, throughout the thing. One thing I say is think about your personalities too, because typical personalities go into these jobs are typically type A chargers.
Right.
Highly competitive.
Highly competitive.
And what you can do with that is when you pull up into your driveway, take that big deep breath and say, I'm going to go in there and be the best dad in the world right now. I'm going to be the best husband in the world right now. Right. And go in there and with that mindset, completely change things around. Leave work behind you and come home and be the best at something again. And so you're not changing yourself.
Yeah.
You're just applying it a little bit differently to that situation.
I love that. I love that. That's terrific, Stu. I have my friend Tanya Bowden, who's a social worker in California, married to an active duty SEAL. She's got a really cool perspective and piece of advice, which is take your uniform off before you walk in your house. Change your uniform, you know, on base before you come home.
Good.
Leave that identity there to the extent that you possibly can.
All right. So we have touched on just about everything, I think, that was on the list. Is there anything, you know, from your perspective that, you know, can best help someone who maybe needs to take the first steps to getting help? What is your recommendation on that? Like you're hearing us talk about sleep and poor nutrition and you're drinking too much and all these things and you're always irritable. What are some of the tools and resources you can go do right now and get your first steps towards getting better?
The low-hanging fruit for me is, do you have a primary care doc? And if not, get one. And then get your blood labs done. Check out your endocrine levels. See what's going on with your testosterone, your endocrine, other endocrine variables. To me, that's the easiest place to start. And a lot of guys I find don't have a primary care doctor or aren't part of a system that provides primary care. So that's something that every man and woman should have, every adult should have anyway, sure. Especially if you're going, well, there's some complex medical, so psychological issues here, potentially having a primary care doc is really important. because they're the conduit that can say, oh, okay, I see a little bit of this. Let's send you to the specialist that does that. Now, none of that, that's not optimal. The optimal would be to go to a program like Homebase or our program in Houston, the Synchrony program, that's going to do a 360 evaluation of everything pretty much simultaneously and look at it all together using a multidisciplinary team. That would be optimal, but that's just not very available. There's not many programs, and they can't take everybody. If you're active duty now, those programs exist. NICO, the Intrepid Spirit Centers, the TBI centers that the DOD has. VA has 5 TBI, polytrauma TBI centers, what they call. I'm not sure what polytrauma means. It's kind of seems like kind of a funny phrase to use for operators that we're talking about, or any conventional forces. Polytrauma.
But I guess once again, they're trying to define it, you know, without saying operator syndrome. It is multiple trauma, I guess, disciplines that need to be taken place by calling it that. So I would agree with you. It's a odd name, but at the same time, it poly meaning many, you know, it could just be a,
I guess
quick answer to try to define what's going
on. Yeah. And I guess what I'm reacting to is the need to name many, because I'm waiting to find somebody that doesn't have many.
Right. There you go.
Seems odd to specify that, but
that's a good point. Yeah,
and I'm not going to recommend the VA because I don't know enough about what they do. And these there's only 5 centers to begin with. So, and what I know about the VA is there's some good folks, good clinicians in the VA, but the system itself has a lot of problems. It seems like I don't hear, I haven't been in a VA in a long time, but I still hear, you know, most of the guys I know won't go to the VA. So the VA is not even an option they will consider, but they will talk to primary care docs. So back to your question, I think that's the low hanging fruit. And I've actually said to guys, hey, take this paper, take the operator syndrome in to your primary care doc. If you have a
great idea,
you have a doc, take it in, review it with them. Check highlight the things before you go in that you think are concerns for yourself.
That's a great idea. Yeah, I think that's a perfect answer.
And then word of mouth. There are programs now. So what are some of the programs out there? You know, there are foundations that will help guys get the hormones they might need. There are foundations that will do, and there's programs that will do brain stimulation, like EEG assisted guided neuromodulation approaches.
All right. Sleep studies.
Sleep studies. Any hospital or care system can do a sleep study. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy is something that a lot of guys are finding to be useful for their brain injury, but then of course it has an effect on everything that the brain injury has been influencing. We don't really have the science yet to support hyperbaric oxygen therapy or HBOT as the treatment for TBI. So our science is lagging behind the practice a little bit, but most of the guys I know that have had HBOT have said it was profoundly beneficial to them.
Nice. So what would you say would be one of the most promising treatments for TBI that you've seen out there? And there may differ for each person, but you know, what are you seeing overall as a group? Is there a particular treatment that's better than?
Probably the most treatment, the biggest bang for the buck for the whole population of special operators is sleep.
Mm. Dang.
And anything that can help sleep. Sleep is going to be the best thing to help a brain heal. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which is very expensive and time consuming. It means going and sitting in essentially a dive tank,
right?
Or a pressurized tank. Yeah. For 90 minutes a day, for 5 days a week, for 2 months, maybe 6 nice. Weeks. So, I mean, it's a significant amount of time, but it's expensive, but there are foundations that will help guys do that if they would like to try that. I don't want to go too far into the psychedelics, but a lot of guys are, I think there's a lot of interest and thought in psychedelic interventions. And I have several friends that have tried several different psychedelic intervention programs and have come back saying it was life-changing. So
I've heard that.
Yeah.
Heard that. There's a unique, I think it was a Netflix show I was watching because that's what I do now. And it was on the some of the history of psychedelics.
Yeah.
And, you know, a century ago, it was the wild, wild west for psychedelics. Yeah. And so, you know, psychotherapy.
50 years ago.
Yeah, not even 100 years ago.
Yeah. And the field of psychiatry and psychology right now are actively interested in studying psychedelic interventions. And so what the operators I know that have gone to these programs, they're kind of out ahead of the medical curve a little bit. One of these programs that I know of is in Mexico, because it wouldn't be legal to hold it in the US. But guys are reporting incredible benefits from it. The field, psychiatry and psychology, we are now actively doing clinical trials all over the country with psychedelic compounds. Ketamine is FDA approved as a treatment for depression.
Interesting.
Psilocybin is well on its way, potentially. I mean, there's interesting studies being done, many of them. Sometimes these are kind of standalone, like take the compound and go sit quietly in a room for a day. Some of these are involve therapy. I know at UT we were doing there was a treatment study one of my colleagues was doing was with psilocybin, magic mushrooms,
yeah.
Treatment for depression, and it was essentially two treatments a month apart. And they're giving the patients the compound in the morning, and then they get a 12-hour therapy session. Tag teaming therapists.
Wow.
So two therapists take turns, basically alternating every hour or so. And then a month later, a second session. And people are finding good results with this. So it's going to be interesting. We're going to have a whole lot of new ideas in the next few years.
That is interesting. How about what you just mentioned, therapy by itself, not with while you're tripping, but just therapy by itself. How has that been helpful for the operator?
That's a little bit hard for me to say because there's not many empirical studies on that.
Okay.
What I commonly hear from operators is, I don't like talking to psychologists. And, you know, after after a career in special operations, most operators have seen 5 to 15 different psychologists over that time, largely because that's part of the process. Psychologists are embedded in these teams and work with the units. But what I often hear is, guys will say, well, I've seen 6 different therapists in the last 20 years, hated them all except for the one. So most of them will be, oh, there's that one person that I connected to. Everybody else was just a fool, is typically what I hear. I think, so now I'll speak to the therapists and the other psychologists out there in the world. The key to working with special operation folks is to be humble, is to be curious, don't assume you have all the answers, and just freaking listen. And I think you go a long way with that. Having a little bit of a contextual nuance of what it meant to have a career in spec ops, given the unit and the branch, I think that's helpful, but it's probably not even actually truly necessary. I think where therapists go wrong is when they jump right in. Oh yeah, I've talked to 10 veterans. They all had PTSD. They were conventional veterans. And then the assumption of, I know what you as a Navy SEAL must be experiencing and suffering, and putting all these assumptions onto you. I'll give you an example. Several years ago, about 4 years ago, the Navy SEAL Foundation put on a health conference in San Diego. And I was there, and one of the speakers was a colleague friend of mine, who's done a lot of work with moral injury. So this is a big thing in the VA right now, moral injury. I'm not quite sure what it means. To me, we used to, in the old days, we called it guilt or survivor's remorse. Now it's been being called moral injury. And in the course of this talk, pretty much all the SEALs that were in the audience and most of their spouses all left and stepped out into the commons area outside the room. And I stepped out too, myself. The conversation outside the room was, we're offended by this concept of moral injury. It's offensive to us. I'm not morally injured. I have no reason to be morally injured. That's one perspective that seemed to be taken. Inside the hall where the talk continued were all the therapists and folk professional caregivers that were there for the continuing education credits. So real kind of schism between the practitioners and the patient or the operator.
Yeah, that really is interesting. I think it's just a bad name, personally. You know, moral injury. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound like
exactly
a good name for what is going on. I will say this on my side, I have found that I listen a whole lot better when a psychologist or psychiatrist can explain things a little more physiologically.
Yeah.
You know, when they talk about the hormone system, you know, endocrine system, and what hormones are being out of balance and what this causes, and like what you've done for the last hour, just listed, you know, some of these, you know, symptoms that occur, not because we're crazy, you know, but it's just because of the job that we've trained our bodies and our minds to do year after year after year. And these are some of the results, right?
Yeah, these are the outcomes. Yeah.
So anyway, I have found that understanding things, you know, because I don't understand things psychologically very well. Understand mm-hmm. things physiologically.
Yeah.
Now a lot of my counterparts will agree to the same thing. They understand what.
Yeah.
You know, muscle imbalances and hormonal right. imbalance, and you know they can. Understand, you know, that type of thing. And then when you start mixing in some of the, you know, skill sets that you've already learned and applying those into helping yourself mitigate stress, that's very powerful, you know, to realize, oh, I've been doing this for years. I just didn't know what it was.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Well, I agree with you, Stu, 100%. And I think that's probably, if I were to criticize my own field, mental health field, I think we don't do enough with the physiology of the human body and the integration of physiology with the behaviors with then outcomes of mood and cognitive states.
Well, it does sound like you're on that road to blending them all in to make a better picture for your patients. You know, by one, calling it operator syndrome and actually defining what that is. I think your advice to print that study out or that paper out and take it to your primary care doctor is probably one of the best pieces of advice I've heard yet.
Yeah. What I encourage guys to do is read it, work their way through it, get a highlighter and highlight each of the bolded, you know, conditions that you think are relevant, and take that in, show it to your care provider. And I think what a lot of folks, I think there's one other small piece to this, which is critically important. Folks from the special operations community, because it's so unique, because it's so different from conventional, the experience of conventional forces, I think they need to make an effort not to assume that people know what a Navy SEAL does and what it means to have been a Navy SEAL. I think a 30-second education to a care provider about, hey, look, this is what I did for a lot of years. And just to give you a quick update, a quick explanation, this is what it means. Just count some of the things. How many hours in breaching courses did you spend? How many jumps did you make? How many dives did you make? Putting some numbers to that stuff is jaw dropping for a lot of care.
It doesn't matter what, yeah. It doesn't matter what special ops program you're in. You do a ton of shooting.
Yeah,
I mean, so much shooting, you get blisters on your trigger fingers, and you know, you're doing a lot of micro blasts that will affect you eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then when you start adding bigger caliber weapons to that, the blasts get bigger, and the unfortunate results also get bigger.
Right.
I mean, like shooting a 50 cal puts you in the Hurt Locker for days.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So, Dr. Free, I appreciate your time so much. I think this has been very valuable. You know, I've talk about tactical fitness all the time, but I don't talk about it on this level that much. You made me smarter today.
So I love a few things too. Thank you, Steve.
So I hope listeners out there can one, not only learn something from this, but also, you know, if you want to learn more about Dr. Free, Dr. Christopher Free, spelled F-R-U-E-H, right? I found him on Google. I was just doing research on stress mitigation, and then I found some terms called operator syndrome, allostatic load, and you can find some great articles and his paper by doing that as well. What I will do, I'll make that easy for you guys. I will put those links in the description of this podcast, and you can just click it and go straight to it and print it out, read it, take it to your doctor, and do it that way. So last word, Dr. Free, any last word for anybody?
I've got two last words. One is for our listeners. It's don't think of yourself as broken, or don't think of your husband as broken. It's an injury, brain injury, and it has a cascade of other effects, but it's an injury. And now it's time to recover and heal. And there's a lot of different ways that that can be done. So don't give up. Look for the answers. Look for the help that you need.
Yes.
And then my second point is just to thank you, Stu. I really appreciate your inviting me on your show. This has been a great conversation. Love what you do. And again, I really appreciate the article you wrote in military.com. That was really terrific.
All right. Well, thank you. With that, everybody, tune in next time. We'll do another tactical fitness report. And Dr. Chris, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Stu.